This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. 50 years ago today, at about 3 p.m. Eastern Time, just about this time, the casket-bearing President John F. Kennedy's body left Dallas's Parkland Hospital and headed for Love Field, where Air Force One waited to take the late president back to Washington, D.C.
Today, Massachusetts remembered Kennedy in ceremonies from Hyannis to the State House to the John F. Kennedy Library in Dorchester.
The impact of JFK's presidency is still felt today almost to the same degree as it was felt when he was president and upon his death.
Across the nation and the globe, many felt as if they had lost a member of their own family.
Please join me in a moment of silence in memory of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
On Radio Boston today, we want to hear from you. Where were you on November 22nd, 1963? What did this moment mean to you? What's the lasting impact of President Kennedy's assassination on America? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
Throughout this hour, throughout today's show, I should say, we'll also be periodically listening back to As It Happened news reports that took place in this same hour, between 3 and 4, 50 years ago. It was roughly at this time, just 2 hours after Kennedy had been declared dead, that a Dallas television station aired a live interview that began with this.
A gentleman just walked in our studio that I am meeting for the first time, as well as you. This is WFAA-TV in Dallas, Texas. May I have your name, please, sir?
My name is Abraham Zapruder.
Mr. Zapruder?
Zapruder, yes, sir.
Zapruder. And would you tell us your story, please, sir?
Abraham Zapruder. He'd been standing in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, and his amateur film of the moment Kennedy was killed would become amongst the most dramatic and famous visual images of the 20th century.
I had a shot, and he slumped to the side like this. Then I had another shot or two. I couldn't say whether it was one or two. And I saw his head practically open up, all blood and everything. And I kept on shooting. That's about all. I'm just sick again.
I think that pretty well expresses the entire feelings of the whole world.
An interview with Abraham Zapruder roughly at this time in 1963. Well, today in Dallas, the city held a somber remembrance of the Kennedy assassination. NPR's Wade Goodwin was there, and he joins us now from Dallas with more. Hi there, Wade.
Hello.
First of all, Wade, just give us a brief reminder of what Dallas was like on the day that Kennedy was there back in 63.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've been watching the live TV, the TV replays here in Dallas that they've been showing of the moment that JFK got to Love Field. And, I mean, people loved John F. Kennedy in this town. I mean, they thronged the fence line, and he waded into the crowd unexpectedly. And it was amazing to see people running all over the parking lot to try to get to him, and also just how completely unprotected he was. I mean, anybody could just walk up to the fence line and, you know, shake the president's hand at that moment. And clearly he was loving it and spent, I guess, 15 or 20 minutes at Love Field shaking his hand. So, I mean, one of the things that kind of impressed upon me was that, goodness, I mean, Dallas might have been the city of hate, but that was really a small group of men at the very top.
Right.
The John Birchers, the radical right wing who hated the federal government. And, you know, the day that Kennedy got to Dallas, the Dallas Morning News was bordered in black, a little welcome from the city's elite. But those men really didn't represent everybody.
Well, what about today? I mean, what was the mood in the city today, since what they were marking was the assassination of the president?
Well, I mean, it's a completely different city. In 1963, Dallas was a small southern city of 700,000 that was mostly white, 80% white. And today, it's almost 5 million people in the Metroplex. Dallas itself is a majority city. 7 years ago, we went blue. We have a black district attorney, and the sheriff is lesbian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that in Dallas now, most of the city kind of feels like JFK was their guy. And so the guilt and shame that Dallas has been saddled with for the last 50 years is almost disappeared. But mm-hmm. the people who did this event today, they still very much cared how it went. In order to get there, you had to win a lottery to get a ticket.
Wow.
And unfortunately, the weather was just a mess. It was a norther had come through. It was about 39 degrees and raining and blowing 20 miles an hour.
Wow.
So if you went, you suffered.
Maybe the right weather for the mood of today. But in the last couple seconds we have, Wade, Mayor Mike Rawlings of Dallas announced plans for a new JFK memorial there in Dealey Plaza. David McCullough spoke. There was some great music. What was your favorite moment from today's ceremonies?
Well, McCullough was great. It's nice to finally have a memorial in Dealey Plaza. The memorial to JFK was a block away, which really signifies something about how conflicted Dallas has been about this. But I think the city is finally getting to the point where it can acknowledge what happened and not feel like somehow it's been unfairly blamed.
That's NPR's national correspondent Wade Goodwin speaking to us today from Dallas, Texas. Wade, thank you so very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's hard to overstate the impact of the death of John F. Kennedy. The assassination of the young president shocked a nation, left it in a state of collective grief. Here's CBS newsman Walter Cronkite just 2 hours after Kennedy was pronounced dead in Dallas.
Now the messages are beginning to come in from around the world and from the cities of the United States, where a nation is in almost, I could say it advisedly, almost uncontrollable shock, it seems. They're weeping on the streets. Schools have to be dismissed. My own school was dismissed because the children were weeping so much they couldn't stay in class.
It truly is hard to quantify that grief. But here's one way. The huge number of letters of condolence that ordinary Americans sent to First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy right after her husband's death. More than 1.5 million of them.
Many of them are preserved in the Kennedy Library here at Boston. In 2010, historian Ellen Fitzpatrick winnowed the collection down to about 200 and published them in her book Letters to Jackie, which has now been made into a documentary film. The book and now the film provide a snapshot of the searing impact of the Kennedy assassination on a nation. Ellen Fitzpatrick is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Give us a sense of the range of people who sent these letters. Who were they?
These letters represent the full diversity of our country. They were from people at every point on the political spectrum. They were from small towns and from big cities. There were people who were barely literate, who wrote with pencil on scraps of paper, and who made an investment to buy a postage stamp, some who walked for miles to mail their letter to Jacqueline Kennedy, and others who wrote on heavy, embossed, engraved stationery. Mm. Every class, every religion, every ethnic group. Extraordinary.
Well, so obviously a real range of letters from a range of people, as you suggested, but as a collection, what do they tell you about the sort of overall impact of this event on the nation?
They tell you, first of all, that Americans experienced the death of John F. Kennedy as a personal loss in their own lives, that this was obviously the death of the leader of the nation, a shocking, violent event, but the way in which that event reverberated into the lives of individual Americans, people really felt that their own lives had been changed as profoundly as if a member of their own family had died.
Well, give us an example of that. I know you've brought the book in. I can imagine out of 200 letters that you culled, it must be hard to say what is your favorite, but pick one out that is at least in your top 10.
Well, this is an extraordinary letter. One of the things that I learned from this collection was that our founders, in their great wisdom, placed power in the hands of ordinary people because that's where they believed that wisdom and virtue resided. And in the sentiments of these ordinary folks, you see this great eloquence. And here's an example. Dear Mrs. Kennedy, I wish to extend to you and the children my condolences. Children increase the cares of life, but they do help to mitigate the remembrance of death. We are told that a good key is necessary to enter paradise. The president, following the guidelines of his church, possessed this key. Heaven, it seems, calls its favorites early. In the president, I felt I had known a whole man. It is a rare experience, but always an illuminating and ennobling one. It costs so much to be a full human being. that there are very few who have the enlightenment or the courage to pay the price. The lights of the prison have gone out now. In this, the quiet time, I can't help but feel that my thoughts and the thoughts of my countrymen will ever reach out to that light on an Arlington hillside for sustenance. How far that little light throws his beam. Sincerely, Stephen J. Hanrahan, 85255, Federal Penitentiary, Atlanta, Georgia.
Wow. That is something.
It's a beautiful letter.
Yeah, it is really something. Was it, I mean, again, the sheer quantity of these letters, I'm trying to sort of get my head around the challenge of picking 200 letters. I mean, we talked about 1.5 million letters. I guess you were culling from a collection of, what, 15,000 at the Kennedy
Yes.
Library. It must have been quite a job figuring out which 200 made the cut.
It was. I would have liked to have published many more, but there was. I was pretty sure that my editor was not going to publish as many as I would have liked to. I think from the 15,000, I found 3,000 or so that I felt were worthy of publication. And then in the end, I really looked for letters that captured the kind of range of sentiment, of emotion, of really reflection on the state of the country in the fall of 1963. These letters really provide a kind of snapshot of the way that people were thinking about our country in that period of time, and not only about the assassination, but about the state of the nation itself.
I want to play a piece of tape. This is from Jacqueline Kennedy. January 14th, 1964, less than 2 months after the assassination, she appears on national TV in her first public statement since her husband's death to essentially thank the nation for this extraordinary group of letters that she's been receiving. Let's just listen.
The knowledge of the affection in which my husband was held by all of you has sustained me, and the warmth of these tributes is something I shall never forget. Whenever I can bear to, I read them. All his bright light gone from the world. All of you who have written to me know how much we all loved him, and that he returned that love in full measure.
So that's Jacqueline Kennedy appearing on national TV January 14th, 1964. Ellen, she promises to respond to all of them. Obviously, she didn't do it personally, but she did make an effort, right, to respond to each and every one.
She did. And there was a black-bordered card printed up that had a simple message that Mrs. Kennedy thanks you for your expression of sympathy, and a staff of many thousands of volunteers over a period of several years devoted themselves to answering those letters. When I began research on the book and I needed to locate the letter writers or their next of kin to get permission to publish these letters, I found that many families had saved those cards, and it meant a great deal to people, as I'm sure she knew it would, to have that thank you.
I'm curious, you wrote recently about this, and I think some of the letters actually get to this idea that many of the letters sort of reference this idea that so many Americans connected the president's death to social and political upheaval in the country at the time, specifically around civil rights.
That's right. There was a great sense of, among some letter writers, of guilt and responsibility. And even in instances where that sentiment was not expressed, there was expressed the belief that a climate of violence and political extremism that many Americans felt existed in the country had claimed the president. Mm. There was an amazing letter from one woman, for example, who said, "The reason that all men mourn the death of your husband is because we feel we have played a part in his murder. Mm. We may not have been there or even known that you were there, but we were all responsible because we did not fight with him in everything he stood for. We just sat back and watched. We have wasted a great man. We may not realize that fault now, but in time, history will write its own story on blood-filled pages."
Oh, boy. You know, it's interesting because I think in these days when we're thinking back to President Kennedy, I think we make the mistake of sort of I don't know, casting that moment before his death is almost this idyllic time in America. But of course, it was a rough time. There were a lot of rough things going on at that time.
It had been a period, actually, of great violence. Mm-hmm. In the spring, of course, of 1963, the Birmingham campaign, which was so important to the civil rights movement, had exposed the entire nation to the scene of law enforcement officials turning dogs on civil rights demonstrators. In June, President Kennedy gave a very powerful speech in which he described segregation and the challenge of the civil rights movement as a moral crisis that was facing the nation. And the very evening of that speech, Medgar Evers was assassinated. And then in the fall, of course, the Birmingham church bombing had occurred. Mm. So all of these things. Adlai Stevenson had visited Dallas a month or so before President Kennedy was there. He was spat upon and hit with a picket sign by a demonstrator. All of these things had made many people feel that it was an unstable moment.
Hmm. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you about this. We're talking to historian Ellen Fitzpatrick. Her book, Letters to Jackie, published in 2010, is a collection of condolence letters that ordinary Americans sent to Jacqueline Kennedy. For those of you old enough to remember, give us a call. Where were you on that day 50 years ago? 800-423-8255. Let's go to Barbara, who's calling from Nahant. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I was 11 years old at the time and in school that day. I grew up in a small rural town in western Massachusetts whose school was too small to have an actual office and a receptionist. There was one phone in the school, and I was in sixth grade, and I happened to be on phone duty that day. One student was responsible for answering the phone when it rang. So I got a call saying that the president had been shot. So I went from classroom to classroom telling people. Hmm. By the time I got halfway through the school, a radio had emerged from one of the teacher's closets, and people were huddled around listening to the news.
Boy, Barbara, thanks so much for that recollection. Ellen, I think all of us who are old enough to remember, I think my recollection, I mean, I was so young, I was 5 or 6 at the time, but I think it's the first time I saw adults in my life cry. And I didn't really understand what it was about, but the memory remains.
Yes, there's. I think that was a common response, and there was a wonderful letter in the collection from a young schoolgirl who talked about hearing the news in school but not believing it, not wanting to believe it. Mm. And she said that she came home and she saw her mother, and she said, and her eyes had truth in them.
Oh, boy.
And so she, at that moment, accepted what she had heard earlier. I certainly remember vividly my own parents being terribly distraught.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Tell me more about that. I wanted to ask you about your specific recollection. You lived in western Massachusetts at the time, is that correct?
I grew up in Amherst, yes.
Yeah.
And Kennedy had actually come to my hometown less than a month before his death. On October 26, he had come to Amherst to dedicate the Robert Frost Library, and I had seen my first American president. I was 11 years old, and it was a very exciting day. Kennedy was greatly admired in my family. My father had been a naval officer during the Second World War. He was born the same year that Kennedy was born, was an Irish Catholic who had grown up in Boston, so there was a great deal of admiration for Kennedy. I was in the sixth grade and heard some teachers talking about it, and they had just heard it on the radio. And I did believe it instantly because I recalled my parents talking over the morning newspapers about Kennedy's trip to Dallas and expressing concern about what kind of reception he would receive there.
Mm. I'm curious to know what you make of the way he's, as a historian, the way he's being remembered on this day. I've read some of the stuff you've written about this, and you point out that historians have disagreed over his presidency, whether he was or could have been a great president. But as you follow the coverage of this 50th anniversary, what strikes you the most? What's missing? What strikes you the most?
Actually, it is what's missing, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I think that there has been certainly a great deal of coverage that's kind of recounting how we heard the news and mm-hmm. where people were on that given day. There's a recognition that this was an event that reverberated into the lives of millions of Americans who really felt profoundly touched by it. But at the same time, I think that there's a sense that people don't quite know how to place John F. Kennedy. There's the contradiction between the way in which his reputation has evolved over the last 50 years, and yet a difficulty squaring that with the continued admiration of this man and the affection with which so many Americans view him. Mm. His popularity ratings today are sky high, and they actually were through much of his presidency. And so I think it's been hard to sort of in any kind of subtle way look at that contradiction.
Really interesting. Before we go, I'd love you to read for maybe just the final 20 seconds here one last letter from your collection.
I will read a letter from a man who was writing on November 28th of 1963. "My dear Mrs. Kennedy, I could not let this week come full circle without expressing deepest sympathy in the great loss of your beloved husband and our beloved president. Truly, the whole world mourns his passing. The impact is everywhere. You drive down country lanes, on off-the-beaten-track roads, and outside of house after house, there is the flag of our country fluttering at half-mast. Fellow citizens mourning outside their homes as well as in their hearts. It tugs at the throat, but you go on, only to have the next friend encountered inquire, 'Have you noticed that the ache keeps coming back again and again?' It does, of course, but it is a precious thing, this grief he leaves us, for the sorrow now would not be so deep if the joy and pride in him and you had not been so high."
Ellen Fitzpatrick is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. She's the author of Letters to Jackie, which was published in 2010. It was made into a documentary. There'll be a free showing of that at the Radcliffe Institute Monday night. More information at radioboston.org. Ellen Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Our special hour on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy will continue. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And welcome back to our special hour on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy.
Kennedy was shot at 12:30 p.m. Central Time in Dallas on this day 50 years ago. It was 1:30 p.m. here. An hour and 15 minutes later, police captured Lee Harvey Oswald at the Texas Theater. By 3:15 p.m. Eastern Time, news bulletins began reporting that Oswald had been taken to a local police station.
In Dallas, the prime suspect still is being questioned. He is 24-year-old Lee Oswald of Dallas, a former Marine who spent some time in Russia, who at one time had applied for Soviet citizenship.
Oswald, who said 2 years ago he wanted Russian citizenship, was fined $10 recently in New Orleans for distributing communist literature. Oswald's only comment to the world at large since his arrest has been a denial.
Not long after that, Oswald was paraded through a hallway jammed with reporters.
I don't know what this is all about.
I killed the president.
No, sir, I didn't. People
How'd
keep
you get the black eye?
Sir?
You shoot the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
Come on, man.
The
no, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet Union. I'm just a patsy.
That's Lee Harvey Oswald at a Dallas police station at just about this time, November 22nd, 1963. So what does this day mean to you? If you remember that day, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or if you're not old enough to have been alive on the day President Kennedy was killed, what does his legacy mean to you? What do you make of the fact that 50 years later, America stops and remembers the day that the president was shot in Dallas, Texas? Again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's roll through a bunch of calls here because we have a lot of people who want to share their memories. Donna is calling from Quincy. You're on the air, Donna.
Hey there, how you doing today? One thing that JFK meant to my generation, and I was there. I wasn't in Dallas, but I was in school. I was in a high school civics class. I was 15 years old, and I always was the kid who snuck the transistor radio into school because at that time I kind of thought school was boring. And I remember the principal coming into my classroom, and he said, "Donna, do you have your transistor radio?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm in trouble now." And he said, "No, we need to listen." So parent just called and said that the president has been shot and we need to listen. So everybody just kind of gathered around. Radio was so important. Mm-hmm. But for a 15-year-old like me, and I was not political. I mean, I was 15. I cared about rock and roll. But President Kennedy represented youth. He was young. He was handsome. He was vibrant. All of the politicians up until then, as I remember them, were just these old people. Uh-huh. And for President Kennedy to be shot and to be killed, as a kid, I just couldn't imagine it. I couldn't conceive of it.
Donna?
And I remember everyone crying.
Donna, thank you so very much for that recollection, and thank you for your call. That's Donna from Quincy. Let's go to the Back Bay in Boston. Mike is on the line. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was only 7 at the time in second grade and in school, and remember the teachers finding out about it and being in tears and being very upset. The interesting thing for me is that 50 years later, although I was only 7 years old, I still feel a great amount of grief about it, and I can only remember a few things about it when it happened.
Well, Mike, let me ask you, why do you feel grief a half century later? Why do you think that is?
Because I think that maybe I experienced it and don't remember it in terms of being around all the adults and all that, because it seems deeply seated in me, but also that I kind of learned along the way, you know, who President Kennedy was as I got older. And I, you know, certainly understand that he was not perfect by any means. But I think what it boils down to is that the sum total of the man is that he was a great man. And I think the loss of a great man, for some reason, it really, really affects me today.
Mike, sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to take it back from you there because I think we got the gist of your point. I really appreciate it. I want to get one more call in here while I have the chance. Sarah is calling from Burlington. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi there. I really appreciate your show today because I'd been thinking about this morning. I was attending Georgetown Visitation in D.C., on the day of the assassination, and we had just come out of sophomore English and we're making the turn to go down the staircase, and the students coming out of the senior American history class, or I think it was junior American history, were just sobbing because they had been listening to the Congress live on the radio, and that announcement had been made. And then it was just like losing a family member.
Wow.
And everything is just a haze. And I remember the bells rang. We gathered in the front hall for the rosary. And then because it was close to Christmas, Thanksgiving break, when I flew home, the other memory I have was we decided to read When Lilacs Last by the Dooryard Bloomed before our Thanksgiving dinner, and my father began to cry.
Sarah, thank you so very much for that call.